When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, it's time for podcast number two. I'm walking to work again. I'm sorry if you got to listen to my flip-flops flip-flopping along. I thought it's about 7 o'clock in the morning, but I need to sort of warm my voice up. Actually, I was in the supermarket yesterday, and I was shopping along, and this, I think maybe she was Malaysian woman that came up. I was listening to a podcast or something. This Malaysian woman came up and she started talking to me, and I was wondering what she was, you know. I was like, and so I pulled out my earplugs, earphones, and she was like trying to hand me something, like a tiny piece of paper, like a post-it note that's all folded up, and she was saying something, but I didn't understand what she was saying, and she was saying, do you want a massage? And she was like handing me this tiny little piece of paper, so I took the paper off her, and I was like, oh, thank you, and I put it in my pocket, and then I was like, I think that might have been a prostitute, it's a bit concerning, really, because I must be looking like somebody who wants to, you know, have a massage. So I put it in my pocket, and then I kept on shopping like nothing had happened. And then another woman came up, and she was like really heavily made up, and she was like, "Do you want a massage?" And she was like giving me this, giving me another post-it note, and I was like, no, it's okay, and so then she looked really, really crestfallen, then like walked away, and then I felt really bad then, because I think she might be thinking that, you know, I was all right with the other one giving me a post-it note, but not her, so I felt really guilty, so maybe strange women coming up and offering for you to pay them to give you a massage with a happy ending, who knows. It may be a sign of maturity. I'm looking more mature. I was walking around in my flip-flops and my shorts and things, looking like a homeless person. But nevertheless, maybe I'm looking looking older. I have a few friends here. I've got a friend from Ghana, and because she's black, quite a few people have like stopped the car, and they're like, money, money, and they're like doing the money sign, and they're telling her to come because they think she's a prostitute. So you have to kind of, if you're living in London, you know, you'd be outraged. This would be on the front page of the BBC website, and you'd have that face where you look really sad and your eyebrows are at 45 degrees, and you know, it'd be like, how terrible the world is. Everyone has to like flagellate themselves, but here it doesn't seem to be that big a deal. It's just a thing of life. So seeing that I seem to be getting, you know, people thinking I'm older, I was going to impart some advice today. So this podcast, I guess I think I'll call it How to Stay Alive, or How Not to Die, which I'm not sure which one's the most positive, but probably how not staying alive. I think that's a film with John Travolta. Not a very good film. If you want to see a really good film with John Travolta, Blow Up. That's the one. Anyway, there's a film. Blow Up? No, that's another film. Blowout. Blowout, maybe it's called. Anyway, very good. So this week, someone I know, Brad Gobright, died in an absolutely accident. And I wouldn't say he was a friend of mine, but I've met him quite a few times. I was on the nose when they broke the record. I was climbing the nose, and what was funny, I actually climbed the nose twice, and both times Brad came past, and on the first time they were going super fast, and I was with some friends, and one of them had just had a piss, and they'd pissed all over this ledge. So when Brad got there, he put his hand in all this piss. So maybe that's slowed him down that first time. And when we got up to the glowering spot, a glowering spot on the nose. Most of the aid climbing on the nose, you don't really have to think about it. It's just super, super easy. But there's one or two bits, low down on the first few pitches, where it's not super easy, and people often get sort of think, oh God, it's all going to be like this, and they freak out and they bail. But the glowering spot, it's not very difficult either, but it's a little bit more difficult, as in it's tiny wires going up this crack, and if you were to make a mistake, you'd land on this ledge. So it's one bit where I always think you have to just slow down a little bit, and you have to be a bit more careful. So it's all about what's the consequences of falling off. Because sometimes when you're speed climbing, so I've climbed El Cap twice in a day, and I tried to solo it in a day, and it took me about 30 hours. So I have some experience of running, doing a whole pitch without any gear in and short fixing and that kind of stuff. So on the glowering spot, I'd done it before. I've climbed the nose a few times, and I did it with somebody who didn't seem to know how to take any wires out. So we ended up leaving an entire rack of wires on the nose, and a lot of the wires on the grit roof were my wires, and on the glowering spot. So the second or third time I climbed the nose, a lot of these wires were mine, and they were still in the glowering spot. So people were just treating it like a via ferrata, and they were just climbing up these wires. So Brad had been using these wires. So I actually started taking a hammer, a really small light hammer, so people could knock the wires out. Because it can be quite hard to, if you weigh 100 kilos and you're bouncing on a wire, it can be quite hard to get out. So this first time Brad was up there, when I got to the glowering spot, I or somebody cleaned all the wires out. So it went from being a via ferrata, where you were just yarding up on these wires, to just being a crack. So then the next time I was on the nose, we were actually on Camp 3, just below the glowering spot. And oh my God, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, your man who brought the record with him. Oh God, sorry, I'm getting, sure, there's a sign of getting old, I can't remember. Crazy man. So I was climbing, and I know, so those guys came up, and they were this was the time they brought the record. And they were going crazy fast. Anyway, so he gets up there, and instead of having this string of wires there, it was just a crack. But it hardly slowed him down, and he was just. But I just remember there was a bit where he kind of got to the last placement for wire, and then kind of slumped into the. He was almost rolling up the just. staggering up this vertical wall. It was like super impressive. Anyone listening to this podcast will know that Brad and another guy were doing a simultaneous abseil, and Brad abseiled off the end of the rope, so Brad fell and was killed, and because he was doing a simultaneous abseil, the other guy also fell, because once he came off the end of the rope, there was no one counterbalancing him, so he fell and amazingly landed on a ledge and just stopped himself from falling down. So when these things happen, like these, I feel like sometimes like you're doing a search for like an old email, some address of somebody you know, and you'll pull up an email where all these people are CC'd into it from like 2000 or 2004 or something, and you look down this list of names, and about 20% of the people have been killed climbing since then. Like if you make a living writing eulogies for dead climbers, you could probably make quite a lot of money out of it, because it's like all too common, really. There's a few climbers who you think should be dead by now who aren't, but there's a lot who are dead who probably, it's more, it's quite surprising they died. Also a lot, it's not surprising at all. So when someone dies, generally you have this, everyone starts eulogizing and like, oh, he died doing what he loved, and all this kind of crap, basically. And it's kind of a coping strategy why people do it. Like I'm kind of on some kind of autistic spectrum. Like you need to think of me like Greta Thunberg or somebody. Like I don't really have emotions like a normal person. So I just find it all this like poetry and all this, it's just I just don't get it, really. I do get it. I understand why people do it, but I just feel like often it's like missing the point. Like Brad didn't die doing what he loved. He died in an abseiling accident. And I think the number one person who would be critical of Brad would be Brad, and then his family. And I think often when there's like a tragic accident, I think people should be angry. I think they should be more angry. I think they should be like pissed off, because like the damage someone dying does, like you basically put people, who you love and you care for, in like a sort of form of living death, basically, for the rest of their lives, like your mum and your dad and people like that. Like I always think it's a little bit like the Truman Show, where the entire world is focused on Truman when he realizes he's in this like big TV program, this sort of false reality. The entire world is like glued at this, when he's finally getting out of this thing, and everyone's looking at it. And then as soon as the moment he walks through the door into the outside world, someone's like, "What's on the other side?" And I think there is a huge aspect of this, of when someone, whether it's Uli Steck or Dean Potter or all these people, like so many people, I genuinely have a thing where I see dead people. Like I see, I just forget that someone's dead. You'll just like, oh yeah, he's dead. Yeah, like it's like a really, it's not good. Like when people, if so many people have died that you can't remember who's alive and who's dead. It's not, maybe that's another sort of coping strategy, that people just put it out of their mind. But I thought I'd I'm still alive, so that's kind of, for me, that's fairly important. But it is, but not the reason I'm still alive is for I have been very lucky in the past. I have done lots of dangerous things, and I've had lots of close shaves and things. But is that luck? That's probably a good place to start. So the idea of luck, like why are some people lucky and why some people aren't lucky, is very complex. Like, I think a lot of it is actually down to, so I'll give you an example. Like, so when people say, like, how many times do you think you're going to die as a climber? Like, I guess I've had so many dangerous experiences, I generally say it's how many times I knew I was going to die. But generally when you know you're going to die, it's generally things beyond your control. But it's the times when you could have died, that's what you really have to start focusing on. And if it happens, if you know, the more it happens, the more you have to start questioning why that is. So good, an example of this, a separate example, was sometimes when I teach people like how to aid climb or how to do a big wall, and they can't put their harness on at the start, they can't put it on properly, I'm like, let's just stop now, because this is the easiest operation, you know. And if you're a grown adult who is a climber, can't put your harness on properly, we're not going to get anywhere. It's just too dangerous for you to do it. You've just got the wrong kind of brain for this kind of thing. So looking back, like, I can pinpoint two things that happened, which are very similar. So one of them was when I climbed the Salathe on El Cap. We ended up, like, I think that was the second time I climbed El Cap. So I climbed the Shield. That was kind of the first big wall I did, and I made loads of mistakes doing that, but none which were, I thought I was going to die. Like, I took like a huge fall, but it was into space. It was okay. So we climbed the Salathe, and we were taking somebody. There was three of us, and then we ended up kind of rescuing two guides, French guides, who didn't bring enough water. For some reason, they had lots of coffee, but they didn't have any water. So we ended up sort of rescuing them and sort of fixing their rope up as we were climbing. And we got to the last bile, which was like under a roof, little roof kind of thing, and it was dark. And so each person was jugging up the rope out from this bile, and I was the last person there. So Paul, my partner, like, shouted, like, release the bags. So, like, release the whole bags. Whole bags started going up. And I didn't have a head torch. So that is something, first of all, to put that down on a piece of paper. Always have a head torch. Always have some form of lighting. Where, you know, in the mountains, wherever, always have some form of head torch. Put your head torch on. Keep it on all day long. You know, whatever, on a big wall, but always have some form of lighting. So the whole bag, like, swung out, and then the rope was fixed. So I clipped my Jumars on, started taking the weight. All my weight was on the rope, and then suddenly Paul shouts down, like, get off the rope, which is not something you want to hear, really. So in the dark, I just reached over, found one of the bolts. Took my daisy chain, clipped into it, screwed it closed, and then it was like just hanging there. Took my Jumars off, just hanging on this bolt. And then eventually the rope moves around. Maybe it was like running over something, and it's like, okay, rope fixed. So I went to unclip myself from the bolt, and what I'd actually done was I had like a screw gate and had a hooked nose instead of a key lock nose. Had like a hooked nose, and as I clipped into the dark, the nose had hooked onto the bolt hanger. So it was actually just hanging from the hook on the carabiner, not the carabiner itself. And when I'd like screwed the carabiner up, I'd basically stopped the gate from closing. So I was just literally hanging on a sky hook or a hook or something. So if I'd sat up and sat back down again, it was a 50-50 chance it would either come off or clip all the way on. So this was like, when I realised this, it just, you know, just sent like a shiver down my spine, like, oh my God. And I think, you know, maybe that was a good, you know, that could have been it. You know, first trip, young climber, first trip to Yosemite, somehow he unclips from the rope, found his dead body, 900 metres down, carabiner clipped to his harness, but the gate's closed, the gate is like the collar is stopping the thing from closing, but it didn't, so I survived. So fast forward like a few more years, went to climb Tangerine Trip in a day. I think it was like May time. Anyway, it was an absolute disaster, and we ended up taking 3 days. We didn't have a portal edge. We didn't have any food. We spent 2 nights. I slept on like a wooden belay seat, and Matt slept in a string hammock. We had one sleeping bag, and it was fucking horrendous. And when we got near the top, there was a big storm, and we're literally climbing the last pitches, kind of Scottish winter climbing, but without any ice axes. I didn't have any socks either. And by the time we got to the top, we were really, really close to hypothermia. Now, if you never had hypothermia, it's really it's very good to experience hypothermia. Like the best way to experience hypothermia is to just go in the sea, like because the sea will just suck the heat out of you straight away. So once you've had it, once you know what it feels like, it's really very good. It's the same with heat stroke. It's good to experience both to some degree, not too much, because it's I think once you experience hypothermia or is it hypothermia? Anyway, once you experience either, I think it actually reduces your tolerance to them. So it's not like you get better at not getting hypothermia or heat stroke. So anyway, so by the time we got to the top, we were absolutely frozen, and we started like trying to get down the east ledges, like in the dark, with snow everywhere. I ended up like falling into the river. Is it Horsetail Falls? I ended up falling into a big pool of water, so I was even more wet. And we got to the top of the Abseils, near the Abseils, and I think we were so tired, not really slept for 3 days. I just couldn't really work out where we were. Like we just somehow, because it was covered in snow, I think it kind of looked different. And I remember Matt was like, "There's a piece of rope here, like tied to a tree, going over the edge." He was like, "Well, just abseil on this." And I was like, "We don't know where it goes. Like, that's not the abseil." He's like, "No, that'd be okay." So he like put his belay device onto the rope and then stood over the edge. Then he looked down, and the end of the rope was where his hand was. Like it was just 2 meters of rope tied to a tree. It didn't go anywhere. So this is another warning sign, is when you're tired, you make really, really stupid mistakes. You just do the most dumb stuff. It's really unbelievable how people can just don't even know who they are or what they're doing. So to avoid getting in that situation is very a good idea. But also, the more you experience extreme exhaustion where you haven't slept for 2 days, 3 days, you learn to sort of step out of yourself. Like when you're doing anything dangerous, you learn to slow down. You can't do it at the speed you would if you just slept. You need to step back from yourself and slow everything right down and treat yourself like you're somebody, you know, treat yourself like you're looking over somebody else who is yourself. So we decided to kind of, instead of like scrambling down these ledges, the abseils, we decided to abseil down for anything we could, because everything, like, going down the east ledges in El Cap is always, I always find it kind of worrying. You know, if you slip, you're probably going to kill yourself. You're going to have a nasty accident going down there. So we're, but now it's all covered in snow. So anyway, so we had one rope which we couldn't abseil on because it was so frozen. It was just completely frozen solid. We had another rope which was like dry treated or something. So that was okay. So we set up this abseil to try and get down to where we're going. And I abseiled down, and when I got to the bottom of the ropes, I realised that I'd fed the rope through the belay device correctly, but when I clipped into my belay loop, I had so many clothes on that I'd not actually clipped into the belay loop. I just caught the belay loop with the hooked nose of the carabiner. So I'd just been hanging, just suspended by the tiny hooked nose of the carabiner hooked onto the side of the webbing. So again, if I'd stood up, sat down a few times, could easily just popped off, had no backup, so I would have died. So the takeaway from, the main takeaway is, like, do not use a carabiner with a hooked nose. Where we have to clip it, where it's like a life support thing and you have to clip it into webbing or whatever. But it's just too easy for it to, you know, not hook on. To be like, it, you know, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. So I think most, like Black Diamond, Petzl, I think most of those carabiners now, the big lockers, have that kind of gate. Always use a backup, like always use a backup. There's no excuse not to use a backup when you're abseiling. It takes about 5 seconds, like you'll be dead for a billion years. So just always use a backup. Like, don't, whether it's a single pitch, whether it's 50 pitches, always use a backup. But now, like, some people just don't, and I just don't get why. Because I think there's a huge aspect of bravado in climbing and just macho bullshit, like, that people think that if you're overly cautious or you're being safe and trying not to kill yourself or ruin the life of your parents and your brothers and sisters and your wife and your children, is you know, that's just a bit too, being a bit overly safe. Safety, you know, there's a place for, you know, safety fifth, but not when it comes to something as simple as that. Because if you're using a backup, whichever way you're going to use it, is that, you know, when you already feed one rope through your belay device and the other one doesn't go into the carabiner, and you lean back, you know, when you're knackered and the rope pings out, you're held by the prusik, or when the block of ice knocks you on the head as you're abseiling down, you know, you don't die, you don't let go of the rope and fall to your death. There's loads of practical advantages of using a prusik backup. You know, before you put your belay device on the rope, you put the prusik on first, you pull some slack through, the prusik holds the weight of the rope, you can put your belay device on without fumbling it. You know, when people try and put the rope through and they're fumbling the device, they drop the belay device. So, like, something that sticks in my mind is Colin Haley, who is, you know, no offence to Colin, but he is someone who, one of these people where, if he was to die, you know, it wouldn't be surprising. And we all know this, so that's my autistic self speaking there. But, so people like that, you know, it's really nice when they just retire, you know, they just get married or something, or they just change what they're doing. So, anyway, but even Colin, I remember reading something where he said he never used a backup. And then Rolando Garabotti, who was a lifer, he was a climber who, you know, has been around a long time. So he's doing a lot of things which are the right things to do. Like, he showed him a way of doing putting a prusik on super fast. And he decided he would always use one. And I hope he's still always using one. Because another aspect of this, if you're doing like crazy shit which could kill you like all the time, there's so many things that are going to kill you. Well, kill you or do something even worse than killing you. You know, you end up as in a vegetative state, or you're a quadriplegic or whatever. Is why, you know, if all these things in your life you can't control, you know, why ignore the things you can control? It doesn't really make any sense to me. So being like becoming like a bit of a safety obsessed asshole is a good idea, I think. So in these like two like these are two tiny little incidents in my life as a climber. But both times it was in the dark. One time I had a head torch, the other time I didn't. Both times I was tired. Both times it was at the end of the day. And I just rushed it. Like I was doing something really, 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 really important, which was, you know, life or death. And I was like rushing it. Like, why was I rushing it? You know, there's some things where you, do you know, if you're a guide, you have this thing, I think it's called, you know, guide speed, where I think it's like, you know, you walk half as fast as normal, then half again, so, you know, your clients can keep up with you. And I think it's quite good to have like a gear system in your brain, where when you're doing certain things, you go into, you know, you go into like fifth gear in your brain. It's like, I'm now doing something, I'm tying into the rope, or I am setting up this abseil, or I am clipping it, you know, I'm clipping into the, you know, all these things that go into the fifth gear of your brain and just really slow it down, check it again. You know, like when you're setting up to abseil. So I'm writing this book at the moment, which is all about abseiling and descending from mountains. You know, and getting into this preloading. You know, so you set up the abseil, and you before you unclip from the anchor, you know, you preload everything. You check the rope is running through the belay device. You check the belay device is clipped into your harness. You check the prusik is locking properly on the two ropes. And this only takes like 1 second. You know, everything's set up. You've checked it all once when you're putting it all on. You sit back. You weigh everything. You check your prusik. You know, check it all. That's good. Unclip. Off you go. So you're slowing down. Like I'll guarantee you. When you lean back on that belay device, and the belay device isn't clipped into your harness, time will slow down anyway. It'll slow down right to the point you hit the ground. So you might as well slow down before that happens. So taking these things, you know, seriously is. It's really, really important. I don't want to sound like I'm some, you know, again, like I don't want to, well, does it matter if I sound like someone who's trying to tell you how not to kill yourself? And yeah, like, so some people like, you know, I've been climbing for years and, you know, why, you know, I'm a very safe climber. Now, there's like, you can be a really good climber, but you could also be like a really dangerous climber, and becoming, you become complacent, like you start sort of cutting corners, like you're always telling people what to do, how to do things properly, but then you think like, oh, don't really do that, I'll just, you know, just, and I think like complacency is, you know, it's like a, it's probably it's a good reason why people have accidents. Like I think it's like 1.25 million people get killed a year in road accidents, and 94% of them are caused by humans. I mean, human like negligence. So that's kind of, you know, the chances of you dying because of a piece of gear fails, or a mountain falls on top of you, it's probably not going to be the case. A good thing to study is a good thing to buy is the Accidents in North American Mountaineering, which comes out every year, and you know, just read through that, you'll see, you know, people, you know, generally everybody just fucks up and they make a mistake. And I would say, having researching for this book, like, you know, I've been looking at like so many accidents, absolutely, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to pull in together all this information that I know already from experience, but then other information from other people, like new ways of doing things, like highlighting where we often do things which are, you know, like there's so much confusion still about how to join two abseiling ropes together, two ropes together, which is like amazing. Like, why do we still have a debate about it? So often really simple things like tying two ropes together is actually very complex because there's so many different elements to it. You know, you're not tying two 11 millimeter dynamic ropes together. You're tying some 5 millimeter Kevlar to a, you know, like a, you know, 9.1 millimeter rope. So there's a lot of like a complexity to it. So I think it's really important to, like, a lot of the accidents, it's where people can are often using they know a technique. So say you're abseiling with like a tag line, and you fed the rope through this mayon, you've tied a knot in it and you've tied the tag line to it, and you're just going to abseil down on one rope with your gree-gree, and then you're going to pull the rope down, which is called blocking. So we can't even, that's another issue. Like, we have like several names for the same thing, and we also have several things which have no names. You know, climbers don't know what you call them. So when so that's another problem. So, you know, so the person's abseiling on the gree-gree, and the weight of one person on one rope. So when you're abseiling on two ropes, you know, the weight is divided by over two ropes. So the amount of weight on the knot is half your body weight. But when you're blocking and you're abseiling on one rope, you know, all your weight is on the knot. So it's actually easier than you think for a knot to creep through like a rapid link, a mayon, a ring, or whatever. So, you know, this person's abseiling, the knot pulls through, they fall to their death. So there's a point where this person knew this technique, but he didn't necessarily understand it. So we live in this age where you have all this information. We have like so much information. Like when I started climbing, you know, there was probably about 5 books, if maybe less than that, 5 technique. Like, I started climbing in the 80s, late 70s, 80s. You know, like a book like, you know, Nigel Shepherd's Modern Rope Techniques was like revolutionary. Like it probably changed. You know, it probably made British climbers, you know, so much safer. Then you had like, you know, John Long's books came out. Like totally, the amount of information that was being imparted through those books was a profoundly changed climbing. But now you have like people just writing so much. You have like forums. You have people who are talking about things. And some things are like everything has the same, seems to have the same value. So like abseiling off a retrievable Fifi hook, you know, if you were to do a, you know, it's probably something that nobody will ever have to do, unless they choose to because they're making a video for YouTube or something. But if you were to just look how many times this really dangerous technique comes up, You could think it was a valid technique and people did it all the time, but it's not. So, you know, all climbers, no matter what they're doing, so Alex Honnold, you know, all these, like, you know, Jimmy Chin, all these, like, you know, people are climbing all the time. You know, 99% of the time, they're just using vanilla climbing techniques. There's nothing fancy pants whatsoever. And it's only on the, you know, like 0.1% of the time when you have to call on things which aren't sort of standard. And that's where you have this, you know, you have this like toolkit of obscure techniques. Like when you, like we tried to, I can remember climbing the Croz, trying to climb the Croz Spur on the Grand Jurasse, and it was like really, there's a part of it was super loose. It was probably, you know, wasn't in good condition. And you pulled off a rock, came down, and chopped one of the ropes we had. We had like sort of twin ropes. It was like an 8mm rope. No, probably thinner than that anyway. It chopped the rope, so the rope was like all, you know, it was knackered. But we kept on going, so we just kind of climbed the one rope. Then a big storm came, and then we had to abseil down, but we only had this one rope. So then, you know, I'd written something about abseiling, you know, abseiling on a single rope and using the other rope to blocking, basically, to pull the other rope down. So that's what we did. So, you know, you'd had this like obscure technique, but knowing it probably saved your ass. You didn't have to get rescued, because to get down, you know, like 400 meters off a face with one rope isn't easy. So you need to know these techniques, but also you just need to understand them. Like it's no good saying, oh, I read this thing on a forum about doing some a crazy knot, is it McCrane knot or something, like this knot where we could put it around this boulder and we can do this, and you know, God, you're gonna kill yourself. So we have this. So, like I've noticed, like I was climbing in Australia this year for like 3 months, and there's always been this issue of, there's always been the issue since the 80s, 90s, of you had like climbing wall climbers and you had like climbing climbers, but I always felt like people who learned in a climbing wall, they seemed to have some sort of humility when they went outdoors, like climbing outdoors, and they seemed to always find someone at a climbing wall who knew what they were doing, who climbed outdoors, and they went out climbing outdoors and they kind of picked it up. And all climbers seem to it's a very, like, climbing is actually incredibly safe. Like you meet people who are complete fuckwits and they do so much wrong, and they seem to fall off, and the belay is standing too far out, and all the wires pull out, but one holds them. And, you know, the capacity for people not to kill themselves is actually pretty impressive. Like, it's not like base jumping. Like, no one ever gets injured base jumping, because they just die. You know, you can't make any mistake, and oh, that's it. Where climbing's not like that. So, you know, so people would go out, and they would, hopefully they'd find another climber who actually climbed outside, and they would, you know, learn how to put gear in. And the human capacity for self-preservation is very high. So, you know, you could give a complete novice, you know, a rack of nuts and some things, and they'll go up, and they'll, you know, they won't be able to push themselves to the point where they can just fall and die, hopefully. They'll just like hang on in there. Like, I remember seeing some people, and they had, instead of quick draws, they had like loops, like prussic loops, like 5mm prussic loops, and they were lark's footing the loops through the wire and then putting a carabiner on it to save, so some people do some like crazy shit like that. So, there's a cock crowing. I do feel though that the amount of information out there, amount of books, forums, websites, that climbers who are climbing primarily in climbing walls can actually like educate themselves to like a huge degree, but they're missing some component. They're missing I've written two or three like instructional books. It's really hard to put your to get into, because you're writing the books, you know what you, hopefully you know what you're writing about. Because your experience, it's quite hard to write it in a way that makes sense to someone who isn't experienced. It's all the tiny little things, because it's a physical. You're not writing about quantum physics. You're writing about putting in nuts and cams and tying knots and all the little mistakes you can make and all the little, you know, variables. So like traveling around, you see a lot of climbers who they're doing kind of complex stuff. So climbing in a Rapalese, you'll see people like setting up these super complex cordlets, like equalettes, all this kind of shit. And then, you know, they'll be like, you know, it's so overbuilt. It's like you're building a bloody, you know, you're rescuing a Land Rover out of a gully or something, you know, this super complex anchor. And then they'll just like, they're on a, you know, a good ledge. And then they'll just kind of drop down over the edge, and they'll be hanging there like a hanging belay below a ledge. And basically what they've done, they've set up a top rope anchor, but they're belaying off it. So, you know, they've got the master point hanging over the edge, so it's not going to rub whatever, which is like totally inappropriate for what they're actually doing. So they've got like all these bits of information, but they don't really understand what they know. So, like, I think it's, you know, if anyone's listening to this, or you know someone who is starting out, like we as climbers, like we have a responsibility, like to sound like assholes sometimes, is to say, you know, you just have to word it in the right way. You know, if you see somebody, you know, it's really difficult, but you know, sometimes you have to say, start talking to someone. Have you been climbing long? Or you just started climbing outdoors? How are you finding it? You know, what's it like? You know, blah blah blah. But, or they'll say something like, why have you got two ropes? And you'll just say, like, because I don't want to die. Have you seen the state of this? Like, climbing in the Blue Mountains, you've got all these sharp, sharp iron bands which are just going to chop your rope. You've got to sink a little skinny, you know, rope. You know, you're just going to die if that goes over at some kind of sharp edge. So, you start a conversation with someone who you can tell is starting out. And then you have to start saying, oh, I noticed you did this. Like, have you ever thought about doing this way? Or, you know, you're racking your cordlet like this. Like, this is a really cool thing. And you can spend like 20 minutes with somebody, and you can impart in those 20 minutes enough information that could really save their lives. Not just save their lives, but make them, you know, save their climbing partner's lives. Like in the past, you had you did an apprenticeship, basically. You know, some older climber, they took you climbing, you know, you watch how they did things. And often people didn't do things the way it's safe either, but they were damn safer than you just reading a book. So I think there's a, you know, we have a responsibility to other climbers, as climbers. Because the more climbers who kill themselves, you know, it's going to make life more difficult for us. Like, you know, I can definitely see a time where, you know, in some countries, they'll just ban climbing, you know. They'll ban cigarettes, they'll ban, you know, anything that's in any way dangerous, they'll just, just get rid of it. So we have an obligation, basically, as climbers, to do that. But you just have to do it in the right way. So I would say, like, abseiling is a really good, you know, good thing to think about. You know, watching people belaying, like, don't be the person. Like, I remember someone telling me, we were walking along the top of Stanage in the UK, and he said, "Oh, you see that boulder there?" So, like, people literally belay off that boulder, and this boulder was the size of a small television, and we were laughing about it. And as he was saying it, a guy came up off the top of the crag, got a sling, put it over this boulder, and clipped into it. And then my friend just went up and said, "Hey mate, look at this," and he just lifted up this boulder, just literally lifted the boulder up off the ground, and the guy was like, "What are you doing? That's my belay." So there's a good way and a bad way of doing it, and some people are not gonna, you know, like. You know, if it's like two women climbing, they're going to think you're like mansplaining to them or whatever. But fuck it, like, you just, you know, women died exactly the same as men. So sometimes, you know, an example of this was a friend of mine. He was climbing next to this young guy who was ice climbing, and this young guy fell off this ice route twice, like onto his ice screws. And this friend of mine shouted over, like, I've been climbing for 30 years, ice climbing for 30 years. I've only ever fallen off once. You've just fallen off twice on one route. Anyway, so within a week, this young guy was dead. You know, he fell off a route and he died. So not being afraid to sound like an old fucking asshole, like, you know it all, is sometimes there's a value to it. So at the other end of the, you know, at the other end, you have the really good climbers. So you have like Alex Honnold and like Alex probably the number one person I'm thinking about here. Is I think climbers need to think more about the impact of what they do, what they say, on impressionable new climbers. We are like straying into climbing being like a cult of death, basically. We have all these martyrs who have died and they're all heroic and, you know, blah blah blah, and no one is ever allowed to be critical of them or why they died or their you know, like deep psychological issues that were going on, you know, in the lives of certain people. And like I you know, like I've met Alex Honnold a few times, and he's expressed opinions about climbers he's climbed with who he thought were really dangerous and he wouldn't want to climb with them again. And I think you know, I think the evidence is there that Alex is just, nothing to do with soloing, you know, Alex is just way too casual a climber. And I think he doesn't, like, I'm going to get into trouble for saying this, but I think he gives the idea that he doesn't really give a fuck about his climbing partners. Now, this is probably just me, you know, but if I feel like that when I watch like free solo or whatever, he's just way too casual. And yeah, maybe his climbing partners are into that, you know, but often there's a thing where, you know, you can climb with people who are really, really good and they're just like just really slack, they're just really they're not holding the rope, you know, they're doing things they shouldn't want to be doing. They're cutting corners. And because you're the less experienced one, you don't feel like you're able to say, like, "Look, Alex, just fucking hold the rope. Fucking belay me. Like, we are going climbing together. Fucking belay me." Like, don't make excuses like we're speed climbing or trying to break. Like, I'm going speed climbing. I'm not going soloing, you know, tied to a rope. So there's a point where we, you know, like, people are watching, you know, when, you know, so people are influenced by what other people do. And I've seen, like, there's always been people soloing around when you go climbing. It's like it's a phase you go through, because you get into climbing, you get better, and then you stop getting better. So then you start soloing, because if you gotta get better, you can kind of show off how cool you are by soloing. And most people tend to grow out of it. They start getting better again. Or the, you know, they just get out of it. But you just see so many people like really, really sketchy, like soloing around. And and I, you know, you can't put all that down on the the shoulders of Alex and people, but there's a point where some things become like normalized and acceptable. And in base jumping, it's the normalization of like everyone you've ever known dying doing it is you don't want to end up like that with climbing. You know, climbing really needs to keep its house in order, needs to look after people, it needs to show responsibility, like in the UK we have this thing called the Jonathan Conville Trust, which is a charity, and it helps fund young climbers going to the Alps, and it helps fund their training. I think it's like 2 or 3 days of training about, you know, crevasses and all this kind of stuff. And we need to have something like that, some more formalized, because we've lost the ability to train young climbers through like an apprenticeship with older climbers. And there's so much information out there. We need to move towards some way of safeguarding people where, you know, I'm sure there's other things like that around, but a lot of people I know who are guides, I think like Kenton Cool, who's climbed Everest like 20 times or something, Rich Cross, people like that, they all went through the Conville Trust. And it's a really, really good system to just give people that little bit of, to have like a mountain guide, just show them like how to do a few things that's gonna keep them safe. Because it really is, the devastation, of someone dying, for us, it's something that's just, it's the news. It's in the news today. We'll all forgotten by next week. But, other people, it's just, that's all they think about for the rest of their lives, like if it's your mum or whatever. And on the other extreme is that, climbing accidents, it's not just about dying. It's about like things which are, it's not a fate worse than death, but we have this kind of Hollywood image of like two superheroes like punching each other in the face and there's no repercussions. And so, there was this fall recently with Emily Harrington and Alex, another. Anyway, we won't go into that. We'll have to wait till the jury's out on that one, what happened there. But, it's like, oh, she had the big bump on her head but she's okay. Now, like, I know, and I'm sure they know as well, I know people who were just sport climbing and the rope was behind their head, behind their leg. They flipped upside down and just struck the back of their head. And that bump on their head completely affected their whole life. Your brain is an amazingly complex machine. Like if you drop your computer on the floor, think what damage that can do. A brain is far more delicate than a computer. It affected their, people. It just affected their relationships, their work, their whole life just changed because they banged their head. So wearing a helmet, that's another good one. I used to have a girlfriend who was paraplegic. She just fell like 10 meters, hit the ground, basically all her gear pulled out, too bald, the gear pulled out, fell 10 meters, ended up, paraplegic, broke her arms, broke her neck, broke her skull. And the effect of being a 21-year-old who's paraplegic on just your life, the life of everyone you know, is profound. So there's a point where we want to experience like danger. We want to be able to be free to really go to the margins, basically, of between life and death. And it's amazing to in this, we live in a world which is so risk averse, to be able to be someone bold enough to do those things is, you know, it's like transformationary in the rest of your life as well. Because, you know, if you're really like holding on to life, you know, as a climber, I think it makes you a much better human being. But at the same time, if you're going to do that, really take it seriously. You know, just really take it seriously. So I'll probably wrap this up. I could probably talk about this like all day long, but I'll leave you with this little one of my little ideas about this kind of thing. I used to cycle a lot. I used to cycle like 24 miles every day. I used to cycle to work up this big mountain, so it was like 12 miles there, 12 miles back, and I was quite into cycling. So cycled everywhere. I always wore a helmet because I've had amnesia twice in my life from a head injury, and both times it was on my bike when I flew over my handlebars, and both times I didn't have a helmet on. So third time I decided to start wearing a helmet. So I always wore a helmet, and I left my my helmet had been stolen, and my bike was at work. And it was when I started being sponsored by Patagonia, and I had to cycle like 20 miles somewhere to meet the guy who ran Patagonia in Europe. So I got on this bike and I cycled like 20 miles, got there, had this, like, you know, you do all your stuff, you sign your life away, all this kind of stuff, you get your free pair of Patagonia socks and everything else. Then I got back on my bike and I had to cycle back to Sheffield, and I'm cycling along. So in my life so far, I must have cycled, you know, a few thousand miles probably on my bike. So I'm cycling along, and I come down this, like Sheffield's got a lot of big hills, and I'm coming down this hill, like hurtling down this hill, and just ahead of me, I could see this car, and everyone was getting out of this car, so I could see the door. The car was on my side of the street facing me, and the doors were open. So in your brain, you're like, you know, just track away from where that car is, because you know, the car doors are open, you know, whatever. And then as I was getting closer, I suddenly saw this thing bouncing around inside, and I realized it was a dog. And just as I realized it was a dog, the dog just like bounded out of the car into the road, and straight in front of me. And he had this thing where the time slowed down, and the dog was right in front of me. The dog saw me, I saw the dog. The dog like cowered down, and I realized I couldn't avoid the dog. Either the dog would move out of the way and keep going, or I was going to hit it. And I hit the dog, and I ended up flying through the air. And I think the bike was actually still. I basically went flying through the air, and I landed on my head. And I ended up like sprawled on the street, and I kind of was like stunned for a second. And then I thought I'd broken my leg, but my bike was still clipped onto one of my shoes, and I just laid there. And I sat up, and all these people started coming out. It's a very like narrow little Yorkshire town, Yorkshire city. All these people started coming out, and my head was like just really bleeding. And I basically landed onto the back of my head, and I had like, you know, blood everywhere. And this old woman came out. She said, "Oh, you've banged your head," and she was like giving me loads of like paper towels. And I was like, I remember saying like, "Oh, don't worry, I've not got AIDS." So I put this thing on my anyway. So I but then just felt really embarrassed. So I kind of got up, and I was like, "Oh no, I'm all right, I'm okay. And I was like, "How's the dog?" And then they were like, "Oh, don't worry about it." So I guess the dog must have been dead or something. So said, oh, I'm okay. So I've put my, so I started trying to cycle away. And they said, oh, there's an ambulance coming. I was like, oh, no, I'm okay. I started trying to cycle away. Then my chain had come off. So then I just started like walking away. And then I don't remember anything else. For some reason, I went to like, I had like amnesia, I had sort of post accident amnesia. I don't remember anything else that happened apart from, you know, like some time later, I was at home and the phone rang and I answered it. Then I put it down again and then the phone rang again. I picked it up and someone was like, are you okay? And I didn't know who I was talking to or what I just said to this person. And I slowly started coming back together again. And I was really, really, you know, really lucky. And had this thing where you have a, apparently it's quite common when people have epileptic fits, where I was completely convinced I knew I was going to crash and hit that dog before it happened. But this is something that appears in your brain after it's happened. Like someone says, I knew I was going to have a fit. Well, they didn't know they were going to have a fit. They just believe it's like an implanted memory. Anyway, so the point of this story is as a climber, you can go through your whole life. You know, as a climber, you can do dangerous shit. You can play it safe. You can just go sport climbing. You can do what, you know, can do it all. But for everyone, there's like, out there, there's like a black dog, and avoiding that black dog as much as possible is what it's all about, I think. To avoid that, like the oh shit moment, the moment where you realise your whole life is about to change, and it wouldn't, and for no reason, like you just fucked up. So, on that cheery note, I shall sign off. So these podcasts, this is number 2. I think they're on iTunes now, YouTube, Google and things. If you like them, please tell your friends or share them. Like the more people listen to stuff, the more I can be asked doing it. And if anybody's got anything they want me to talk about, any questions, I shall try and talk about them. So I shall turn off. So see you. I'll post these podcasts every Friday. So I shall see you next Friday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.